Binge. Thanks for tuning in. Jack Brighton is the producer for Focus 580, and at the controls this morning is Brian Wagner. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about our future as a maturing society. And our guest for the program is historian Theodore Rozsák. He's professor of history at California State University at Hayward. He is the author of a number of books, and we'll be talking about his most recent, which is titled America the Wise, The Longevity Revolution and the True Wealth of Nations. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, came out last fall. And it takes a look at the consequences of the graying of America. One sort of demographic fact, one that he acknowledges within the first few lines of the beginning of the book, is that more people in the United States are living longer. However, that really doesn't tell you very much. It is much more interesting when you look at this in a little bit better depth, a little bit greater depth, than you look at who it is that we're talking about and how perhaps they differ from their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, and how conditions for seniors in the United States are changing, and in fact how American seniors are changing, and what that means for the future of the country. Those are some of the themes Professor Rozsák explores in his book, and we will be trying to explore here in this first part of Focus 580, or this second part of Focus 580. Questions, of course, are welcome if you want to call in. We encourage people to participate in the conversation. All we ask is that people are brief so that we can accommodate as many different folks as possible and keep things moving along. But the number to call if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, that one good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you want to join the conversation, you're welcome to do that. And of course, we'll talk with a guest and see what he has to say on the topic. Well, Professor Rozsák, hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for talking with us. Perhaps you might talk a little bit about how it is that you started thinking about these themes that you take up in America the Wise.
Well, it's a very personal book in many ways. My interest in longevity as a social phenomenon began as a very personal matter. I suddenly realized that I was going to experience it. This was about 10 years ago when I went through a horrendous medical crisis and recovered from it. And then just a few years ago, my wife went through a similar crisis, open-heart surgery. We both came out of those experiences realizing that we were going to live a lot longer, or we were very likely to live a lot longer than our parents or grandparents had. And that, as a matter of fact, we were part of something very big that was happening in the society. It's very simply summarized, more people are living longer. That's the beginning of an idea. As I explored it more deeply, I discovered that that fact is accompanied by another one, which is that families, not only in America but throughout the industrial world, are shrinking, and shrinking dramatically. And that means that every industrial society in the world is experiencing aging as inevitable. It's built into their very structure. And that, it seemed to me, was an astonishing fact, that as industrial societies progress, they are going to get older and older. That will happen inevitably. And so the question is, what do we think about that? I don't think we have ever had to recognize the possibility of what may be a permanent senior dominance in our future. We're very used to thinking of ourselves as a youthful society. But in fact, the demographics are very clear. Industrial societies must age. And that, it seems to me, is an astonishing fact, is unprecedented in human history. By the next century, we will be approaching a point where there will be more people above the age of 50 in most industrial societies than below the age of 50. Never happened before in history.
There has certainly been a lot written in popular media about this demographic trend and the implications of it, and it seems to be largely negative. It is written about as being an enormous problem, or perhaps some collection of problems.
Right, that was the next thing I flashed upon in taking an interest in this subject. In fact, my wife and I, like literally millions of other people, have been offered the gift of life. We are part of this process called aging. And yet everything I was reading about it on all sides was so gloomy and so negative. And so, you know, I decided to sit down and think this through. The gift of life, a longer, healthier life. How can that possibly be a bad thing? By what set of values or cultural assumptions does anybody come to the conclusion that a longer, healthier life for more and more people is a bad thing? It seemed to me it was a very good thing. In fact, I'm prepared to define it in this book as the true wealth of our nation, that we are able to give so many people a longer, healthier life. That led to a lot of political analysis of where this gloomy perception comes from and who it is that believes we can't afford this and that seemingly we should begin demanding a shorter lifespan. and it turns out that it is a very political matter. There are people who are used to the idea that we are a youthful society. They think that's where the market for goods is, an aging society is less of a high consumption society in their view. There are others who feel that big government programs like entitlements programs are just plain bad, and now they see that those programs are going to expand. They will have to expand, both Medicare and Social Security. And there are those who simply don't like that on political grounds. But if you stand back from that and think about it in very human and very personal terms, it's a great good thing that's happening.
Central, I think, to the book is the idea that the people that were part of the what you called the counterculture, the people who were the political social right. activists of the 60s, these are the folks now that are entering upon their golden years, or at least these are the people that are now starting to move into their 50s.
Yeah.
And that you're arguing that as then they get older and they make up the bulk of older Americans, that the attitudes that they bring with them, their life experiences, the state of their health, the degree of their education, everything that makes up who they are will lead us to think very differently perhaps about aging and about the advantages of having the bulk of the population in these older age cohorts.
Absolutely. At some point you have to ask a question. Who is it that's doing this aging? Every generation, after all, has had a different historical experience. The population we're talking about now, as part of this longevity revolution, is the baby boom population of the United States, people born between the 40s and the mid-60s, who are going into their senior years in the next 10, 20, 30 years. Now, that generation has had its own peculiar history, just as every generation before it has had. But it does turn out that that generation of Americans is the best educated, the most politically savvy and engaged generation of Americans that we have ever seen. It will live through a period of great protest. It is used to thinking daring new ideas. It seems to me that there's a very special population that's leading us into this new demographic frontier. It's a population that does not have many of the characteristics of previous older generations. And for one thing, it's just a very big generation. You know, we are one of the most difficult adjustments we are going to have to make is recognizing that we can no longer think of older Americans or the elderly as a small, scattered, powerless group of people about whom we ask, what are we going to do for them? Right. That question is passing from our politics. It simply doesn't make sense anymore. We're talking about a society where older and elderly people will control the bulk of our national wealth. They will do most of the voting. They are going to decide what we're going to do with them. And they are no longer a small, scattered, powerless group of people. Political power is shifting into their hands. And that makes an enormous difference. We have never had to think about older people, the elderly, as being, as having power as well as wealth. You know, the words poor, old have always gone together. Well, that's not going to be true in the future.
Let me reintroduce, just for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here, let me reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We are talking with historian Theodore Roget. He is a professor of history at California State University at Hayward and has written a number of books. And his most recent, the one that explores these ideas we're talking about here today, is titled America the Wise, The Longevity Revolution, and the True Wealth of Nations. It is published by Houghton Mifflin, and it came out last fall, so it should be out there in the bookstores or the library if you want to take a look at it. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, you know, I'm interested in maybe picking up here for a moment on the last point that you made, because it's my perception that that seniors have been a group that has exercised at least some influence in politics on some perhaps limited range of issues, and that they have exercised that influence because politicians have appreciated the fact that they do indeed vote and perhaps are more inclined to participate politically than younger people. So for that reason, you know, politicians have taken certain stands on certain issues, particularly things like Medicare, Social Security, mm-hmm. and so forth. If indeed that older Americans become more, say, it becomes a larger group, and given the fact that they are motivated to investigate social issues and work on that motivation not only by voting and other sorts of things, I mean, if this becomes an even more important block in terms of national politics, how do you see that shaping or influencing politics? What will be the implications of that?
We have been aware of the growing voting strength of the senior population ever since the 1970s, mm-hmm. and through the 80s and into the 90s. But by and large, our perception of that voting strength has identified older voters as an interest group, an interest group that has only a couple of interests, namely Social Security and health care, Medicare. And that may have been true back in the 70s and 80s. But bear in mind what I'm saying. The next older population is not going to be a small an interest group. It's going to be it's going to grow toward being the majority of our citizen body. And that means that it has not only more power, but it has more responsibility. In fact, one of the purposes I wrote the book was to encourage older Americans, especially baby boomers, as they move into that period of life, to recognize their responsibility. They can no longer pretend or aspire to being little more than an interest group voting for their self-interest, because what they're going to be voting for in the way of Social Security and Medicare as their most immediate interests will impact every other economic priority in the society. Therefore, they're going to have to look for a broader, more balanced view of how we allocate our national wealth, precisely because there will be so many of them. They're going to find that they're not asking for a small part of the pie, the national pie. They're asking for a very large part of the pie. And that's going to impact things like education and the environmental cleanup and military expenditures and everything else in the society. So the next generation of seniors, precisely because it is going to be so large and have such strong needs, is going to have to take a much larger view of its place in our society. Now, in the past, senior voters have not had to think that way. They've been able to say, look, we're a small group of people, we have a certain interest, and we're going to vote to defend that, and they could afford, in a sense, to be selfish about that. That's not going to work in the future, because their selfish interest is now going to have such an enormous impact upon the rest of the society that they're going to have to have to grow up and recognize that we have a power that brings with it an enormous responsibility. So in the book, I appeal, it's a sort of a mission statement for the next senior generation to be as noble and as generous and as public-spirited as they can possibly imagine being. They have to become a different kind of a citizen, a different kind of a senior citizen. They have to bear the public good, the public interest as a whole, firmly in mind.
We have a caller to talk with, and others are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455, and if you match those numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL. It might make it a little easier to remember the number. So 333-WILL. Also, we have a toll-free line, and if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. We will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. First caller here is in Eureka, and that is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. You've been kind of talking around the edges of the question I have, and I realize it's a hypothetical and a little difficult, but give me your best ideas. Do you see the demographic of the increasing importance of the, I guess I would classify it maybe as the post 62 or 65 year old voter having a more conservative impact on society, except for possible issues such as Medicare and Social Security? Do you see any research or have any hunches of anything in that direction?
Well, in my book, I analyze the older population in America into three very distinct groups that have very different voting habits and very different values. There are the what are called technically now the oldest old from 85 on up, which is incidentally, believe it or not, the fastest growing segment of our population simply because they are experiencing better and better medical care. That's a population that dates back to, the 1920s and remembers when old people were all poor old people without even a social security system. There's a middle older group, which is our first entitlements, the senior generation, people now in their 60s and 70s. And I take all of these into account along with the baby boom generation, which is moving toward its retirement, post-65 retirement. Each one of these groups has different characteristics because each one has had a different experience of old age, from total powerlessness to, in the near future, a great deal of voting and social power. And each one of those groups, therefore, is probably going to wind up having a very, very different political profile. As I've mentioned, when the baby boom population becomes the dominant senior population, it is going to be making demands on the society that are much greater than ever before, and it's going to have to work out a very balanced view of what our society needs. You can no longer simply try to trade off the interests of education against the interests of Medicare. You just can't do that. That's not a responsible way to vote. And so their voting habits, I think, are going to be very different. And what the baby boom voting pattern is going to be like when these people are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s is up for grabs. That's why I'm writing this book, to try to educate that population to start thinking much more broadly about questions of health care and social security. The position I work to in the book is a radical one, I suppose, not at all a conservative one, and that is that these two entitlements programs simply cannot any longer remain the privileged domain of older people. We need a Social Security program for children as well as the senior citizens, and we need health care across the board for everyone. So I suspect that what will happen in the future in order to make these demands politically negotiable is that what we now think of as the senior entitlements will become the entitlements of American society as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. So in your mind, though, that whether or not this group of folks you're talking about, the new people, that's the phrase that you described.
Yeah, I used it in the book to be dramatic about how different this is going to make us as a society, yes.
Well, it still seems to be, in your mind, an open question of whether, indeed, they'll rise to the challenge or not?
Well, of course. I mean, because you're talking about an enormous number of people, you know, some 80 million Americans going through a major demographic transition in their lives. You take your life in your hands trying to make a firm prediction about what will happen. So the book is partially predictive, but it's also an appeal to people to recognize that our political demographic situation is shifting radically, and that it requires rethinking a number of things in our society. For example, it requires rethinking how rich we are as a society. You know, the major gloomy prediction about the aging of our society is grounded in the idea that we just don't have enough money to afford this. And you hear that again and again. Social Security, Medicare, they're all dooming us to a fiscal train wreck. Well, in writing the book, you know, I simply reviewed what I think we should all become aware of. We are a very rich society. We spend twice as much every year on gambling than we spend on Medicare. So when you raise the question, can we afford Medicare, can we afford Social Security, you have to ask, well, what are we now spending that money on? Ask the question what we can afford as a people when you're standing in the middle of a shopping mall, right? And you look at all the, you know, the consumer goods around you. We're an enormously rich society. We have more than enough to afford what other industrial societies are affording for their senior population and for the social security of their population as a whole. And I think those issues are going to come home to us very dramatically within the next 10 to 20 years when we finally sit down and say, what is it we want to use this money for? Mm-hmm. And I think we will. It will occur to us that long life and good health are the. This is the one expenditure on which there is an enormous public consensus. I cannot imagine anybody taking issue with that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also the case, and you write about it and you comment on it, that it seems that the people that we're talking about also are not going gently into their senior years. They are as enthusiastically, many of them, committed to the cult of youth of this country as anybody else, and seem to be sometimes grasping at whatever pill or surgery or product or item of clothing or material possession or whatever it is that they think is going to keep them from getting old.
Yep, that's true.
It seems to be that we're going to have to become mature also in the way that we think about maturity, and that abandon that sort of idea that says that if you don't want to, you don't have to get old.
That's absolutely right. In fact, that's one of the things that is one of the great ironies about the longevity revolution. The very population that's now leading us into the demographic frontier we're discussing, the aging of our society, is the same population that stamped us with a national identity of youth back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that image of America as a youthful society is still with us in all of our advertising, in all the commercials you see. Our media are still skewed toward what's called the young demographic, 18 to 34. It means that the media and the advertising people have not yet caught up with the wave of the future. They're in a sense, waging war against the United States Census Bureau. They haven't recognized yet. They're reluctant to recognize that we are an aging society. And so in their view, aging is something wrong. It's something unnatural. It's something that shouldn't be happening. But, of course, it is going to happen, and eventually they will have to adjust to the fact that the older population, well above the age of 50, is where the money is and it's where the numbers are. And that will happen inevitably because you can't just keep ignoring a massive fact like that. But in the meanwhile, until we get to that national realization of who we are as a people, I think a lot of people are going to struggle with the aging process, try to put it off, defy it, evade it, elude it. And there will be people in the marketplace who rush forward to give us everything from youth pills to cosmetic surgery to all kinds of fixes for what is an inevitable process. I think that's true. There's a whole chapter in my book called The Senior Follies, the number of ways in which I see people around me resisting the inevitable.
We are about at our midpoint here. Let me just remind people that our guest is Theodore Rozhak. He's professor of history at California.
Professor, I think I agree with everything you say. In fact, you sound like such a nice guy, you're actually melting my heart a bit. I'm 53 years old, so I'm right smack in the middle of those people that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Given my current mood, if I get to be 70 and I have that political power, I think I have every intention of sticking it to them. I have lived in a society where I have seen the rich take over the medical system, the rich take over the educational system. They have provided for nothing for their seniors and for their kids. I'm talking about little kids.
Yeah.
I've seen elderly people. I have a tenant in one of my buildings who can't afford the $24 a day that it costs for her heart medication. So as a result, she's in and out of the emergency room, all because Medicare won't care for it. My wife is foreign-born. She's a French woman, And for 20 years, my father, who was a staunch conservative, just made endless fun of the French system and how it was going to bankrupt the world and they were going to go down in catastrophe. And one day my mother went into the hospital, and 6 weeks later he was sitting at the desk with $48,000 worth of bills.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the wrong end of it because Medicare wasn't covering crap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he said to me in almost a tearful way, he said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry to have made such fun of that system."
Mm-hmm.
And when he saw friend after friend of his go down to financial ruin, to a psychological collapse, families broken apart because of the evils of this system that is provided for the wealthy and not for the poor, I'm not in such a good mood if I'm going to get into the position where I've got an iron hammer in my fist. I'll tell you.
Yeah. Well, listen, I sympathize with your orientation. In fact, I offer some pretty devastating critiques in the book of how we are handling medical and health care in the United States. You have to recognize that the first move in what is, I think, a lengthy and struggling transition has been for very profit-minded interests to take over our medical system, just as they now want to take over the Social Security pension system and turn it into a rich prize on the stock market. We're talking about turning trillions of dollars into the hands of brokers and fund managers. At least that's one very powerful proposal on the scene. Now, all of this is an attempt to grab off as much of the wealth of the nation as possible for profit-making purposes. In the long run, this will never work. But in the short run, it may indeed be tried. In the long run, the only way any industrial society will handle a transition of this kind is by large public programs that are generously funded. Currently, people in rather well-defined conservative interests who have been beating the drum for privatizing Social Security have been trying to work up a great deal of generational animosity, the old against the young. Basically, that makes no sense whatsoever, because these are not fixed categories of people who will be forever old or forever young. We're talking about a fluid identity. We all move through the identities of youth and age. So the deal we cut, this is an important political point, the deal we cut for senior citizens today is the deal that the young people of this country are going to get when they reach their senior years. And they ought to bear that in mind. Moreover, if you don't provide a decent, dignified, and independent retirement for older Americans, they will not vanish in a puff of smoke. They will wind up coming home like chickens to roost, and they will have the same situation we had back in the 20s and the 30s, where it was commonplace for families to have to support not only their own children, but their parents and grandparents. I don't think that system is going to prove acceptable to Americans in the future.
No, I agree with you. And people don't realize, you know, for example, the lady that I know, whenever her son finds out that he's doing it, he goes out and he buys the medicine. So it's a tax on him.
Now, yeah, I mean, we're talking, you know, nursing home care in this country can run $30,000 to $40,000 a year.
Right.
Most Americans are eventually, and now, incidentally, an awful lot of those costs are, in effect, being funded by families by keeping people, often very dependent, very frail elders, at home and paying all the bills and knocking off work to take care of them. You've probably heard of the number of women in our society who are now called a sandwiched generation. They're women in their 40s and 50s who have raised their own children and are now taking care of their own parents. I suspect that population of women is going to speak out very loudly within the next few years and say, this is a raw deal in life, and there has to be a better way, a more professional way, to handle this major demographic development. This is more than families were ever designed to handle in the past. And we're talking about an older generation that will survive into its 70s, 80s, 90s, perhaps beyond 100, out of the workforce. It's got to have something to lean upon for its own dignified independence. It cannot simply come home and live in the attic or the basement.
Yes. Well, thank you for your clear
thought.
Very interesting.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll go again to someone here now locally in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Maybe you've already answered this question, but I was curious. I've heard it said often, I worked my whole life and now I deserve my check, my Social Security check. Where did that come from? Did the government actually print that sentence?
Well, no. I mean, ever since the 1930s, we've had a Social Security program, which has been defined as an entitlement, if not an economic necessity for the society. You know, before we had that program, which incidentally is not a terribly generous program, if you're living on nothing but Social Security, you are not living very handsomely at all. But before we had that, we had nothing, absolutely nothing. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we have the current system. Back in the 30s, a doctor named Dr. Townsend, who was in his 60s, had no political background at all, began campaigning for an old age pension plan in the United States. The main reason Dr. Townsend opened that campaign was because he, as a doctor, found himself attending an enormous number of suicides. They were mainly older people, parents and grandparents, who could no longer work and who did not want to burden their families back in the Great Depression. So they killed themselves off. And Dr. Townsend registered the number of such things happening, said this is a tragedy in a society as rich as ours. This society has to try to afford a decent pension for its senior citizens. And ever since then, we have offered at least a pittance under Social Security to preserve some degree of dignity and independence for older Americans. I ask myself, what's the alternative to that? Of course these people should have a claim after a long life of working to a decent retirement. Either that or the economy has to provide them with jobs. Mm-hmm. And if that's not... If we don't do one or the other of those two things, where are we leaving people at the end of their lives?
Right. I know that it's not very much money, but the question, we have two sets of parents in our family, and one punched a time clock in the city of Chicago, and the other one had a professional degree, and the one that punched the time clock, their entire family was very dependent on that check.
Sure.
And they knew that check was going to come, and they needed that money.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that check should actually be a much larger check, and we could afford it.
But, you know, on the other side, here was my question. I had a grandmother, wife of a minister, that lived into her 90s. She never worked at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, you see, she got that same check as these people that punched a time clock.
Well, it's been an important aspect of Social Security that it has been an unquestioned entitlement across the board. Because if you try to get into the details of who deserves it more than someone else,
mm-hmm.
you've been pitting one group of elders against another. Who did white-collar work? Who did blue-collar work?
Yes.
That sort of thing. So what we decided, I think, with great intelligence and generosity, is to say after the age of 65, people have a claim to this. It's really a minimal kind of support. Now, my feeling is that it should be a much more generous kind of support, and indeed, it should be an entitlement. Now, if people earn a very great deal of money in their retirement years, they lose their Social Security. I mean, so I'm losing the first couple of years, at least, of my Social Security because I continue teaching.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy for me to continue working as a teacher.
And you'd prefer that, probably.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm not ready to retire in the sense of having no work at all in the world. But on the other hand, you know, my father was a carpenter. Died at 47 from overwork. He had a heart condition. He should have retired at 40. He would have, you know, lived a longer life.
But the check provided then for your mother.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think it's important to recognize one of the ideas that's being broached is that of raising the retirement age. It's one thing to raise retirement age for professors, stockbrokers, people like that. And another thing to raise the retirement age for construction workers and agricultural workers and, you know, bricklayers. And, I mean, they're doing heavy work. You can't just... Moreover, how many of us would want to have, airplane pilots or brain surgeons who are still on the job at 80? So, you know, you have to be intelligent about the idea of work and retirement
mm-hmm.
and have some sense of the nuance of the matter. Some people can continue longer and others can't.
Yeah, I find it complicated and interesting.
Yeah.
Both.
It asks us to evaluate the kinds of work people do and of course, give them some discretion themselves over what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But my feeling is that a retirement program in a high industrial society as productive as ours should err in the direction of generosity.
Mm-hmm. Probably so.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
The there are countries that are ahead of us on the demographic curve, in the sense that that it's happening more rapidly because they are either at or actually below replacement level in their birth rate.
Yeah.
As you look at, you cast your eyes around the world and look at in other places, is there anyone who seems to be would serve as a model for us, would suggest this is the way to approach it, or are they having
I can nominate one country right away, and that is the Scandinavian countries.
Hmm.
Scandinavian countries now have a life expectancy up into the 80s, and they have very generous programs, not only for senior citizens, mind you, but for children and young marrieds. They have a highly developed social security program. Now, they pay very high taxes for that. I mean, that's one of the first things people always observe. They do. But on the other hand, the program works very well for all concerned. I mean, I have visited Sweden, and it seems that they are very content with their system. Now, we may not be able to do that. But what has been interesting to me is the number of conservative elements in our society who have suggested that we shouldn't imitate Scandinavia, we should imitate Chile. And they keep pushing the Chilean model of how to handle retirement, which is, incidentally, a very speculative matter of putting the money in the stock market, and it has not been working out terribly well lately. Well, you know, if I had to choose a model from all the world, I would choose Scandinavia rather than Chile. The country that's actually working out these problems in a way that may speak to our condition is Japan. The Japanese are now the oldest society in the history of the world. They have more people above the age of 65 than below 16. And they are adjusting in the direction of more and more generous social security for their senior citizens. The other industrial countries, including the United States, have been very critical of their efforts to do that. But I suspect that Japan, which is working this out now, currently, over the next generation, is pretty much our future. We should be looking to what they're doing and learning from their efforts, and indeed from some of their troubles and problems.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with historian Theodore Rozhak. The book, by the way, again, if you'd like to read it, is titled America the Wise. It's a book that he has written that examines the theme that we're discussing here this morning. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Next caller up is Belgium, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It seems to me that retirement really is a very new concept. Admittedly, we've dealt with it now for 30 or 40 years, but our parents' generation really didn't retire. Well, I'm saying the generation that was born back in the late 1800s, they didn't retire. They worked until they died.
Yeah, true.
And so this whole idea is new, and maybe that's really not all that bad. You know, you need to stay active in life.
Oh, well, I mean, it's one thing to stay active. I mean, I think that everybody wants. I have not met, in my recent speaking, any senior group where people want to simply molder away on the front porch in a rocking chair.
But they
in fact, some of the most
they do want
active
stuff.
People I've met are now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. I mean, they have an enormous social agenda, and they do a lot of community service, and they work with children. I mean, they're really admirable people, and they are far from retired in that.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, but I also knew many people in the generation that I refer to that worked well into their 80s.
Sure.
If they were well enough to even get around at all, they worked.
Well, you know, as long as that's voluntary and people take joy in it, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I intend to keep working until I drop.
Well, we have to develop.
I'm a writer and I'm a teacher. I'm not a bricklayer. I'm not a roofer. I'm not a ditch digger. So, I mean, as I gave you an example. My father, who was a construction worker, probably should have retired at 40. It was not good for him to continue.
Well, I understand that, sir. But we have developed people who have a mindset that don't want to work past 65.
Well, you know, actually, I have met. Well, let's distinguish two things: work and jobs. Jobs are socially defined things. That's not always under your control whether you can have a job. You have to get someone to employ you. My impression is that employers are making it very difficult for people from about the age of 45 on to continue.
Well, I agree 100% because I'm in that group.
Right. So
I have found my own work. Well,
that's
my own work.
My impression is that a lot of people want to continue working. They cannot all manage to get jobs in the marketplace. So work should certainly continue as long as people want to continue doing it.
Yes, it is the thing that keeps you alive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We shouldn't be dependent on employers in order to keep active and working.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go to Chicago for our next caller here. This is line number one. Hello.
Thank you. In an economic environment where a winner-take-all mentality and on one end and a condition where why are Americans consuming so much and not satisfied, and another condition with the young and youth who are unable to postpone gratification and satisfaction being a condition that we're living with, as well as governments and themselves in a quandary, like the G7 group trying to get together about how governments should proceed in the economic sphere, dealing with the big fish swallowing the little fish, until how many big fish are going to be around to deal with how things should be wheeled and dealt and maneuvered, and on. You have a case where economic interest in this country may be usurped by ownership of due to the wealthy people in other countries, and vice versa. So we're in a condition where we may be wiser, but I don't know if we've actually been able to wear enough knowledge to get us through this, and we have to have a really extensive display of all the things that are happening with greater openness and transparency to really find.
Well, I'm not sure if there was a question in there, but I certainly hear an important issue, and that is, I think the general shape and direction of what we're now calling the global economy is very much at odds with the longevity revolution I'm talking about here. I think that the needs of aging populations are very different from the needs of high-rolling, hard-charging global entrepreneurs who are oriented toward the bottom line, high profit, high productivity. But an aging population needs a very different set of priorities. That has a lot
of volunteers and activists.
Yeah, volunteer economies, fulfilling work even beyond when you're off the payroll. A decent and dignified retirement, health care. These are all the needs of an aging society, which I suspect are, within the next 10, 20 years are going to clash with all the values of the global economy we've created.
Sure, because some economies are based on a Social Security a welfare system that couldn't care less about many people being unemployed. And,
absolutely, and that, I mean, that's going to become an intolerable social burden. And similarly, health care, the cost of health care is bound to go up. We have to all anticipate that. But on the other hand, is there any better way to use the national wealth than affording longer, healthier lives? But if the health care system insists on producing profits for everyone along the line, then the chances are that will at some point be seen as unaffordable. We're going to have to find some other system for providing those longer, healthy lives besides the profit motive.
Yeah, balance and harmony is something we have to strive for. Yep. Thank you.
Yep.
All right, thanks for the call. And again, we'll go to another caller. This is Aurora, line number four. Hello.
Yes, you speak of the aging population coming up. And I am concerned with, and then you're saying that the aging population will be larger than the population behind it.
Well, it depends on where you draw the line. I mean, eventually, in the next century, there will be more people above the age of 50 than below in our society.
Uh-huh.
We will reach that point, yes.
So then I'm concerned about who is going to take care physically. I don't mean the medical. I mean physically to take care of this aging population.
Right.
Larger population.
Well, I'll give you an idea about that. You know, back in the mid part of the century when everybody was buying gas-guzzling automobiles that were going to need a lot of maintenance and repair, what we generated was a whole new line of work, which was taking care of automobiles. That became a life's work for many people. I suspect in the coming century we're going to have healthcare professionals, caregivers who are highly trained and whose purpose is to provide as much comfort and security and stability and joy and fulfillment for an aging population as one human being can provide for another. It will simply become one of the things people do in our society. And I've already met young people who are looking forward to having a profession in caregiving for senior citizens.
Well, I wish it was now.
Yeah, I do too. We're behind in that. But I can see that coming in the future because it is simply a necessity.
I take care of my aging mother,
yeah.
And it's very difficult to find caregivers.
Well, you know, you are among the people who must speak up on this issue and say, look, I'm part of a social issue that's becoming larger and larger and larger. It's not just a personal matter. This is a big
social
problem.
Well, the state of California spoke to it.
Yeah, right.
Yesterday, the union won, after 10 years of fighting, to give caretakers $7.25 an hour, as opposed to the $5 they get in Illinois, and they just won't stay with a job. They'd rather be on welfare.
A lot of this is in transition, and it's going to shift simply because that's where the numbers and the votes and the money is going to be. People are going to recognize this is it. We are basically going to become a healthcare economy in the 21st century, with caregiving being one of the major professions that people train for and go into.
Well, and I wonder about these countries that are either killing their babies or adopting them out of their country, their female babies.
To get more young people going around the world.
Well, you get more men, but men are not nurturers, and just generally speaking, they aren't. And I
actually
just wonder who's going to nurture these countries that kill their female babies or adopt them out of the country.
Yeah. Well, that's still another issue, I agree. I mean, I have actually heard somebody propose that Japan in the next generation is going to have to import youth, young people, to make up for the aging of their society.
Yeah, I think nature did it very well when they had 105 babies born to 100 female babies, 105 male babies born to every 100 female babies. That was the way it was naturally planned out. But somebody's
that's a better arrangement by far, right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right, sure.
Well, we're sort of getting down to the last couple of minutes. Do you find yourself, I wonder, feeling optimistic that as we grow old, we're going to grow up?
Well, look, here's my major orientation. We have been talking about aging as some kind of a calamity that we can't afford. Hmm. I've decided to look at it in a very different way. This has been one devil of a century to live through. World wars, revolutions, the atomic bomb, the balance of terror, genocide, ethnic cleansing. I mean, the number of terrible and evil things that have happened in the 20th century is enormous. But you know, one good thing has happened. More people are living longer. I think we should cling to that and value it and say this is the one thing that's come out of this troubled century that is of benefit to all of us, that we can all share in longer, healthier lives. That is inevitable, and it is good. And I haven't seen many people talking about this change in that way. Well, I think we have to start thinking of it that way. What's the alternative to a longer, healthier life? Are we going to advocate shorter, sicker lives? And on the other hand, why don't we just think of this as good? This is what the money is for. This is what the whole industrial process has been for, to bring us to this condition. We've got it. We should value it and make the most of it.
We'll have to leave it at that. That seems to be a good point.
It's been very enjoyable being with you.
Well, we appreciate you.
For letting me have so much airtime.
We appreciate you giving us your time.
Right.
Our guest, Theodore Rozsak, if you look for his book, the spelling and his last name, Rozsak, he is a professor of history at California State University at Hayward and has a number of other books in print as well, so you might take a look at those while you're looking for America the Wise. That book, this one that explores this territory we've been talking about here this morning, came out last fall. It's published by Houghton Mifflin and should now be available in the bookstore or the library if you want to take a look at it.